Welcome to this special edition of Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. You're about to hear a forum featuring candidates from the 7th Congressional District that was broadcast live on October 13th here in the WHQR MC Ernie Gallery.
We're joined by two of the three candidates tonight. David Rauser, the Republican candidate, declined to participate, citing two other public events in October to which the press is invited. After serious consideration, we decided to move forward in spite of that, as it is not our role to base news coverage on likely outcomes or polls or pundits. Rather, we consider it a critical part of our mission to facilitate the democratic process. I'm thrilled to have WWAY News Channel 3 anchor Chris Brown with us tonight to join me in asking questions of our candidates during the first portion of this forum. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you. Good evening, Rachel.
The 7th Congressional District covers Johnston County, Sampson County, a large part of Lenoir, fragments of Cumberland, Hoke, and Robeson, all of Duplin, Bladen, Columbus, and Brunswick, most of New Hanover, with the exception of a small corner in the northwest portion, and the coastal edge of Pender County. Mike McIntyre, a conservative Democrat from Robeson County, has served the 7th District for 9 consecutive 2-year terms. His announcement in January that he would not run for a 10th term took the public by surprise. Now, let's meet our candidates in alphabetical order. Jonathan Barfield, a Democrat, owns his own realty firm and is a current New Hanover County Commissioner. He's served 1 full 4-year term on the board and is halfway through his second term. During his time as commissioner, he's served twice as chairman and twice as vice chair. He's the current county representative for the Department of Social Services, the Tourism Development Authority, and DSS's Methamphetamine Task Force. He's also served on the Blue Ribbon Commission on the Prevention of Youth Violence and is assistant pastor of New Beginning Christian Church. He's married and has 4 daughters. Welcome, Jonathan Barfield.
Glad to be here, Rachel and Chris.
Wesley Castine is running on the Libertarian ticket. He's a lawyer and CPA and maintains his own practice in Wilmington. Mr. Castine is a lifelong resident of North Carolina, graduating from James Keenan High School. He earned a degree in accounting from Wake Forest University. He later graduated from law school at Campbell University and received a postgraduate Master of Laws degree in taxation from the University of Alabama. He's also authored a series of books, Musings of a Southern Lawyer, and he lectures frequently, including as an adjunct professor at UNC Wilmington. Wesley Castine, welcome.
Rachel and Chris, good to be here.
And I'd like to recognize our all-important timekeeper, Lindsay McGrath. Hello, Lindsay.
Thank you, Rachel.
The format goes like this. Chris Brown and I will begin with our prepared questions. Candidates have 90 seconds to answer each question. We will rotate the order in which candidates answer. There will be no opening statements in order to allow more time for questions. Lindsay, the timekeeper, will signal when 30 seconds remains, then again at the 15-second mark, and she will ring the bell when time is up. There it is. In the second portion of the forum, members of our live studio audience may ask questions. If we get to additional emailed questions at that point, we will. In the final segment, each candidate will have 2 minutes to deliver a closing statement. And if we need to go to a speed round in the event of a time crunch, both candidates will, of course, be given abbreviated, albeit equal, time to respond. Let's begin. Chris Brown, please direct your first question to Jonathan Barfield.
Good evening, candidates. Congressman McIntyre, Mr. Barfield, was known for being a moderate and reaching across party lines. Name a way that you would differ with the powers that be in Washington that you think will help get things done in Washington.
You know, Chris, what I want you to know is this. As a county commissioner, I mean, the only Democrat on the board for the last 6 years, but I've been chairman of the board twice and vice chair twice. It shows our ability to work across party lines for the betterment of our community. Former governors Evan Bayh and John Husband have this great initiative called No Labels, where they're asking members of Congress to check the labels at the door and find ways to pass bipartisan legislation. That's something I would definitely be a part of, as I find that people are tired of the Hatfields and McCoys mentality in our country. They're ready for a government to come together and work together for the betterment of the people as opposed to party affiliation. You know, as a pastor, I tell people all the time, when you die, there won't be a Republican or Democrat, heaven or hell, just heaven and hell. So therefore, my job as a county commissioner now is represent all the citizens in my community, and as your congressman, I'll indeed be a representative of all the people. Whether you're rich, poor, black, white, Republican, or Democrat, living in a nice neighborhood or not, my job is to make sure that your voice is heard and that your needs are indeed met.
Thank you, Mr. Casteen. Same question.
And I echo that the history, recent history at least, of Congress has shown that it's polarized. It's ineffective, it's inefficient, there's not a lot getting done because both sides are staring on opposite sides of a line in the sand pointing at each other. As the first and sole libertarian in Congress, it would be incumbent upon me to reach out to both the Democrats and the Republicans and the legacy parties and say to them, you know, what changes can be made? What changes can I adopt as my own and say what incremental changes are there that can be made in Congress and in the government that moves the status quo from nearly nothing? We have the opportunity to do things, and there are things that have been proposed by various members of Congress. You have David Camp proposing tax reform. You have North Carolina Senator Richard Burr and other Senators Hatch and Coburn who have proposed alternatives to the Affordable Care Act. You have Alan Simpson and Erskine Bowles, who were on the Deficit Reduction Commission. They have all proposed plans and provided opportunities, but nobody wants to consider those. Everybody has sort of walked away from major changes, but instead want to squabble about the things that seem to be coming along every day, and it's management by crisis, and that needs to change.
Thank you. This next question begins with you, Wesley Casteen. Governor Pat McCrory has said that North Carolina should explore all available options for alternative energy, including hydraulic fracturing, offshore wind energy, offshore energy exploration, solar power. What forms of energy production do you think the state should engage in, and are there any items on the menu you'd like to remove?
Well, it's been described as an all-of-the-above energy policy at the federal level. And I think that it's important to recognize that so long as America is dependent upon the fossil fuels that come from the Middle East, America is going to be embroiled in the conflicts that arise in the Middle East. So for our national security, for our energy independence, I think it's appropriate to consider any form of energy that provides a dependable source of fuel at a reasonable risk. No mining of any type, no fuel production of any type is going to come without any risk, but it's necessary to analyze that risk and to investigate the alternatives. And given the alternatives, it's important to see what can be done in the long term to reduce energy dependence. As far as hydraulic fracturing, I'm not a hydrologist, I'm not a mining expert. But I would say that anything that provides opportunity should be thoroughly investigated, and if it provides an opportunity without creating an undue risk compared to the other available forms, it's certainly something that should be pursued.
Thank you. Mr. Barfield, same question.
You know, Rachel, I am an environmentalist at heart. I attended the Coastal Energy Summit this past week at the Convention Center and heard from a representative from the American Petroleum Institute as they talked about offshore drilling, about hydraulic fracturing, about the many forms that they would like to use to indeed produce energy here in our community, in our country. And my concern is this: if what happened in the Gulf of Mexico happens here off the coast of North Carolina, our tourism economy would completely sink. Right now we have over 5,000 jobs that we know are directly related to our tourism and travel in our community here, just in Newark County alone, not to mention Eastern, Pender, and Brunswick counties. And to have those economies totally decimated because of an oil spill would be horrendous for years to come. When you look at the hydraulic fracturing, the fact that we're going to mine and allow other materials to enter into our groundwater, not understanding what the full implication of that would be for those that are using well water for their drinking water, I have grave concerns there. You know, we've talked a lot about wind energy, solar energy, and solar energy. Putting wind farms off of the coast, I think, will be a great idea. I've watched presentations about wind energy, and I feel that it will be a great asset for our community. And then looking at Sampson County, the fact that Duke Progress Energy is now building a 500-acre solar farm, I think it's another great way to tap into the energy potentials of our community without harming the environment at the same time.
Thank you. Chris Brown, your next question goes to Mr. Barfield.
Mr. Barfield, the nation is on edge about the spread of Ebola. Steps are being taken on a national and local level. What more should Congress be doing to take steps to limit the spread of the virus or prepare for a possible outbreak?
Well, it's great to see that we're collaborating with those in other countries, especially Africa. Number one, to make sure that the screening takes place there. But if we have someone on a plane that's coming from those communities, also have the same type of screening here in the U.S. as well to make sure that nothing is moving forward. You know, it's a shame that we had a nurse who was working with a young man that passed away that now has Ebola as well. We definitely have to step up our safety precautions with our medical professionals that are serving those individuals that may come down with Ebola. But again, working with those from other countries to make sure that we can stop it on that end before it comes to our country.
Mr. Castain, same question.
It presents an unfortunate situation where we have yet another disease which is uncontrolled that provides a threat specifically at this time to West African nations, but as Mr. Barfield has indicated, it's come more recently to the United States and has been transmitted human being to human being here in this country. My concern is that the CDC and medical facilities have not demonstrated the level of preparedness that I would have expected given the repeated reassurances of the CDC that they were prepared, that the facilities here in the United States were able to take care of isolated patients and to prevent the spread of the disease. That has proven not to be 100% accurate as the nurse has contracted the disease while caring for a patient. Another concern of mine is that the CDC announced that the nurse contracted the disease due to a breach of protocol, but was quick to say, we don't know how the protocol was breached. So I'm not sure how you can define it as a breach of protocol without identifying the lapse. I'm concerned that there is a attempted reassurance that is not really appropriate at the CDC because I'm not confident that they really understand the risk and are prepared to deal with it.
Thank you. You're tuned to a special broadcast of the 7th Congressional District Candidates Forum here on HQR News 91.3 FM. We're also streaming live on WWAYTV3.com. Two of three candidates are with us tonight, a live studio audience, and Chris Brown from WWAY. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. This next question begins with you, Mr. Castain. A recent study by the Pew Research Center shows that Americans and the British are unique, being two countries from advanced economies that tend to blame the gap between rich and poor, more on individuals' lack of hard work than on government economic policy. This contrasts starkly with other advanced economies, such as Greece, Spain, South Korea, and Israel, who tend to say that government policy is a larger influence than individuals' work. What factors do you think are responsible for the shrinking of the middle class and the growing income gap between the wealthy and the poor?
The Great Recession put a strain on the overall economy, and there's no question that the upper ends of the economic spectrum have recovered much more quickly than minimum wage workers and those at the lower end. The things that could be done to fix it are more difficult to come by, obvious in the fact that we're 7 years almost into the Great Recession and recovery therefrom, and we're still struggling. But what has proven not to be effective is government interference in the markets as being the cure-all for the problems that affect the economy. The small business owners will be the avenue to recover, and to the extent that government can encourage but not manipulate those small business owners, to the extent that regulations can be avoided that stifle growth and creativity, that's the things that are going to bring the economy full circle. Unfortunately, much of the problem is an expectation that government will fix it. And unfortunately, I am not so confident that government has the ability to fix those problems. And I think eventually the market will have to be the avenue of the recovery.
Thank you. Jonathan Barfield.
Can you repeat the question, please, Rachel?
A recent study by the Pew Research Center shows that Americans and the British are unique, being two of the countries from advanced economies that tend to blame the gap between the rich and the poor more on individuals' lack of hard work than on government economic policy. This contrasts starkly with other advanced economies such as Greece, Spain, South Korea, and Israel, who tend to say government policy is a larger influence. What factors do you think are responsible for the shrinking of the middle class and the growing income gap between the rich and the poor?
You know, Rachel, in every capitalist society, you're going to have winners and you're going to have losers. When I look at what happened with WorldCom and looking at Madoff and the fact that you have many that sit in seats of authority and power and think of ways to defraud others of their inheritance or their resources while making themselves richer on the other end. With what happened with Madoff and all the folks who were affected by that, you see these stories over and over and over again. To now there's a TV show on called American Greed, showing the greed that's happening within our country. I serve as chairman of the Department of Social Services Board, and what I find is that the faces of those that come there, Rachel, have changed. It's not just the normal poor that you would normally see, but it's those individuals who have lost a job, working in banking, as a lawyer, in industry, and now they're trying to figure out, how do I make ends meet? I've gone through my child's college fund. I've gone through all of my savings. Now I need to come to the government to have resources to even put food on the table. The faces are indeed changing in America. And it's time for us to step up, number one, and recognize that, number one, as you have the haves and the have-nots. I believe in raising the minimum wage to at least give someone something close to a livable wage to be able to take care of themselves and their families. It is said that it takes roughly $12.50 an hour in this community right here to be able to afford the average apartment. So a minimum wage worker can't even afford an apartment based on working full-time 40 hours a week in that environment.
Thank you. Chris Brown, your next question to Mr. Barfield.
Mr. Barfield, federal funding for beach renourishment has always been an uphill battle to procure. What will you do to fight for the funds to keep our beaches whole?
You know, Chris, as a county commissioner, this is something that we work with every day. And the reality is, until this new Congress came in several years ago, there were always earmarks for beach renourishment, looking at the fact that tourism is the lifeblood of the economy right here in southeastern North Carolina, all the beach communities that are here. I will work hard to restore those federal earmarks to make sure that we have adequate resources to renourish our beaches, but also to dredge our inlets. As a county commissioner, I have worked to provide funding to dredge the Carolina Beach Inlet. We work on an MOU right now with our Tourism Development Authority and our other local community partners to provide the right funding in place to dredge those inlets. But looking at our tourist economy here, the fact that there are so many that are coming right here to New Nineveh County, to Brunswick County, to Pender County, to our beach communities, we've got to find a way to make sure that there's sand on those beaches. If not, those tourists will leave, just like the film industry is looking at leaving here. And then what will our community be? Half of what it is right now. So I want to indeed work hard, as I always have, to make sure that those dollars are there to renourish our beaches.
Thank you, Mr. Casting. Same question.
Mr. Barfield referred to the beach renourishment funds as earmarks. The problem is that every community across the country the size of Wilmington is going to have an earmark that it wants the federal government to pay. And the problem is that 3/4 of the federal budget is for things that aren't really discretionary. You have Social Security, you have Medicare, you have interest on the debt, and you have national defense. When you remove those items from the budget, you have less than 25% of the federal budget, which is actually discretionary, that Congress has any real choice over what it's going to spend. And that's where those earmarks fall into. The problem is that the federal government is spending more money than it takes in. Deficits are projected through 2035. National debt is exceeding $17.5 trillion. Interest on the national debt is nearly $500 billion a year. It's not possible for the federal government to continue to pay for the expectations of every community throughout the country for what Mr. Barfield refers to as earmarks. I think it is appropriate to continue to try to wean the local communities from those expectations and encourage the local communities to find alternative financing sources for beach renourishment and things that they are used to being funded by the federal government, because it's not a matter of if those funds will stop, it's just a matter of when.
Thank you. Mr. Castine, we've heard the term government overreach a lot throughout this election cycle and the intrusion of government on American freedoms. Do you believe that the government is overstepping in any particular area, and if so, how?
I believe that there are two primary areas. You have government regulations. Most of the laws of the federal government come not from Congress, but come from bureaucratic alphabet agencies in Washington, D.C. And each one of those agencies is its own fiefdom, and each one of those agencies attempts to justify its existence by the continued passage of regulations. Unfortunately, there's rarely a consideration for what the cost of those regulations might be. And without considering the cost of those regulations in enforcement, in implementation, and the cost to business owners and consumers in the long run, it's unreasonable to pose those regulations. As I stated a few moments ago, in doing so, it stifles creativity and it hurts the economy. The second area that I would say there is overreach is in the domestic surveillance program through the NSA. None of us question that there is a need to keep Americans safe. None of us question that there are people in the world who threaten the United States and its citizens. However, I would say that it is not appropriate to maintain a dragnet of domestic surveillance for citizens who have shown no reason to be spied upon by their own government.
Thank you. Mr. Barfield.
You know, there are times when there is a bit of overreach within federal, state, and local governments, but I find that in those times, the American citizens rise up and share their concerns and let their voices be heard, and that many times that overreach can indeed be quelched. You know, as a county commissioner, we complain a lot about the state, the fact that the counties are an extension of state government and we get unfunded mandates coming from the state. The state complains that they're getting updates that are coming down, but the reality is we still must meet the needs of the citizens that live here in this great country called the United States of America. You know, one of the things that I see right now is the waters of the U.S. is coming down from the EPA. The fact that they're trying to regulate the very ditches that are in front of some people's homes to say if you get more than 2 or 3 inches of water in your ditch, the federal government must come in and regulate that. And I think that's indeed going to be an overreach. It would be an unfair burden on the taxpayers of our community. It would cause insurance rates to indeed rise. At the same time, I see where the federal government is helping the coastal communities when you look at the fact that we have a subsidy for flood insurance. And, you know, I don't think that the average citizen in these communities here could afford the full cost of what flood insurance would cost for the residents here. So I think that there are ways that our government does help, and sometimes we just need to step back some.
Thank you. Chris Brown.
Mr. Barfield, with the rise of ISIS, the president has authorized airstrikes, but some are calling for boots on the ground. Is that an option you would consider if elected?
Chris, that would be my last resort. I was in Washington back in September and heard from General Ordinaro as he was talking about the actions that are taking place as relates to ISIS. And the fact that the airstrikes are what they deem the most appropriate action right now to specifically target certain targets that ISIS has to eliminate their strength and their power. You know, as a Navy veteran, I've seen men and women come back from Iraq and Afghanistan with missing limbs, arms that aren't there anymore. As I go to the National Cemetery for our many memorial services here and I talk to the Gold Star mothers who have lost sons and daughters serving in our country, the last resort for me would be putting boots on the ground. I don't want to see any more of our men and women in harm's way, but what I'm happy about is the fact that many of our allies, those that we've built relationships with over the many years, are now coming to the table. And I think that it's incumbent upon the other nations within this world to come to the aid of the U.S. and others to fight this battle together. It cannot be just the United States alone fighting every battle across the world. The others have got to step up and step in. Now that we see that others are being executed and it's a terrible thing that's happening there from other countries, those countries are stepping up and saying, hold up, we need to represent our people here as well.
Thank you. Mr. Castine, same question.
ISIS has killed Americans. ISIS has threatened to continue to kill Americans, and other radical Islamic groups have indicated a desire to attack the United States homeland again. The plan, as it is, does not provide for boots on the ground. The problem with that plan is ultimately someone, whether it's the United States or whether it's some of the coalition forces, will have to put boots on the ground in that area in order to fill the vacuum that will be created if there's an attempt to run ISIS or the Islamic fundamentalist forces out. So there has to be a plan. My concern is that recently when the bombing started, the administration stated that there was no budget for what was going on. They could not give a cost estimate. My concern is that if they can't tell what it's going to cost, if they can't tell the sacrifice that's going to have to be made by America, how is it can they make the decision to go in the first place? How is it that they can sell the decision to attack in a foreign country if they have not made the decision of here's what the cost is, here's what our commitment's going to have to be? And without that, it's a concern of mine that they don't know if there's going to have to be boots on the ground, and ultimately there will have to be a change of plan that will be a commitment that the United States is not prepared to make.
Thank you. You're tuned to a special broadcast of the 7th Congressional District Candidates Forum here on HQR News 91.3 FM. Wesley Castine, North Carolina's voting law has garnered national attention. Critics call it a voter suppression law. Supporters say the new rules protect the integrity of the elections and make it harder to commit voter fraud. What do you think of the law, and what result would you like to see after the case goes to trial next year?
The case has already been heard on several levels. A decision, of course, has not been rendered. But the Supreme Court has apparently not viewed it as such a deterrent to voting as to step in and uphold the injunction that was issued by the Court of Appeals. Democrats and Republicans alike historically have done things to improve their likelihood of getting elected, from redistricting to gerrymandering to voter access laws. Whether that was the intent, I can't step into the shoes and the minds of the legislators and say that's what the intent was, but again, the Supreme Court has looked at it and not identified it as being so much of a deterrent as to justify stopping those laws as they are implemented this year. So again, I would defer to the courts to make that determination with full information as it becomes available.
Thank you, Mr. Barfield.
You know, Rachel, as I look at this whole situation, I find that we as a state are going backwards as opposed to forward. I talk to so many that come to our community and they came here because of the progressive nature of North Carolina, but they find that it's more regressive as opposed to progressive. When you look back on American history, the reality is it wasn't that many years ago that a person like me didn't have the opportunity or the right to vote. And now I find that those very rights are being stripped away one by one by one. There was a point in time when African Americans had to count the number of jelly beans in a jar to be able to pass the test to be able to vote. And somehow you can never realize how many jelly beans were in that jar. Now we have these different voter suppression tactics, changing the rules to limit access, limiting the number of days of early voting. When you look at 2008, we had a record voter turnout. When I ran for office that year, I could talk to people in line for 45 minutes to an hour as they were waiting to vote because people were excited about the opportunity to cast their vote and their ballot. Now we've eliminated straight ticket voting. Again, that's something that the other party, Republican Party, I guess, looked at and said, well, they've always voted straight ticket. They come out in large numbers, so let's take that away as well to make it one more step to indeed vote for that person that they want to vote for. And to me, the things that are happening in our state are just out and out wrong. When you look at this, the fact that this county right here has only had two African-American county commissioners since 1898, you know, there's something in that. And those two are me and my father.
Thank you. Chris Brown.
Mr. Barfield, Congressman McIntyre was also known for constituent services and being very visible on a local level. How do you plan to continue that trend if elected?
I'm doing it right now, Chris. As a county commissioner, I've been one of the most accessible elected officials here in our community. Folks often say that you're everywhere all the time, and that's my goal, to make sure that I'm there in the communities, understand the needs of those that I serve. And I often say that I can't help you if I don't know your name, if I've never been to your community. So therefore, this county, whether it's Creekwood or Landfall, whether it's Rachel Beach or Carolina Beach, I'm always there involved in the community. We plan to have several offices set up throughout the district with folks that will indeed run our constituent services to make sure that we're hearing from those, but also having a Facebook page, having a newsletter that will go out periodically to inform citizens on what's going on, but not just a one-way communication. Let that be a two-way communication as well. That way they can indeed contact me anytime. You know, with the cards that I pass out, my cell phone number is on there, and once elected, that won't change. Citizens will always have access to their congressman, and I will return their phone calls if I don't answer right then, as well as email. But I do believe in being visible and active within the community, and I'm going to translate that into the entire 7th Congressional District.
Thank you, Mr. Casting. Same question.
The 7th Congressional District is my home. It's been the home of my family for 7 generations. I grew up in Duplin County. I call Wilmington home these days. So for the past 200 years, even before there was a United States, my family has been in this area, and I'm attached to it and want to do everything that I can to make the most of the 7th District, and that's why I'm running. The people of the 7th District are family, they're friends, they're not just constituents, they're not just voters, they're people that I know, they're people that I've grown up with, they're people that I call friends. And you're right, Mr. McIntyre was very active in the community. I had the opportunity to see that firsthand when there was a resident who had a dire need, and I was able to call upon his office, and they directly stepped in and were able to assist in that need. And that gave an excellent example to me of knowing, you know, what can be done through the Office of Representative and how to look after constituents and residents in the 7th District, and I would like to continue that example as Congressman.
Thank you. Wesley Castine, an NBC News analysis recently bemoaned the lack of bold ideas in this year's elections, quoting a well-known campaign strategist as calling this year's race an election about small things. What bold ideas would you bring to Washington?
As one of 435 representatives, I think it would be completely unrealistic in all candor to say that I'm going to go to Washington to change things. I would be the first libertarian in Congress, and anyone who says that they're going to go to Washington and change Washington on their own is either disillusioned or disingenuous. What I will offer to the people of southeastern North Carolina is an honest review of the legislation that comes before Congress. I will offer to support and promote legislation and opportunities that come my way in which I can become aware, but the change has to be incremental. The change, if there's an attempt to make a wholesale systematic change, it can end up causing more harm than good. The Affordable Care Act was just such an attempt. The objectives were admirable, but the implementation has been flawed. You've got a new bureaucracy that's looking to take over 20% of the gross national product, and the implementation has been flawed not only through the Obamacare websites, the ACA websites, but also through other implementations. Certain parts of the program have even been dropped because they were not able to be implemented as originally proposed. So again, there are changes, and I would say that an incremental approach allows the most productive use.
Thank you.
Question is about bold new ideas. And I would like to look at how we spend our money, how we do our processes within the federal government. You know, when I served in the U.S. Navy, I was a part of a brand new command in Key West, Florida, and we had a building that we came in and completely revamped, redid, spent hundreds of thousands of dollars to get this building upfit, only to have that command leave several years later, and I visited Key West because my wife is from there, and went by that same building, and it's falling down and dilapidated, and I find that there's a considerable amount of waste in government. I would like to look at applying the lean process to our federal government, changing processes, changing steps, changing the way that we do business on a day-to-day basis to find ways to reduce costs and to save the American citizens money. And we can better take those dollars that we're going to save and put those into public education, into the infrastructure that we have in our our country to make it grow economically. But again, changing processes. I'm on the board of trustees at our local hospital here. We've got a lean department there that's roughly 4 years old, and its goal is to save at least $1 million a year for the hospital, and they're exceeding that by leaps and bounds. But it's all about going in and changing processes. When you look at General Electric, they're talking about their loan process, but with that, coming into corporations and showing them how to take one process out, one step out, and save money. And that's what I want to bring to Washington. And that I think that indeed will be a new idea.
Thank you. We do have a question from a member of the live studio audience. Please step up to the mic, state your name, and ask your question.
My name is Elizabeth Woodside, and McIntyre obviously was popular enough to get voted 9 times. So I'd like to know what you would do to continue what he's done for this area, and what would you do differently?
Thank you, and we'll begin with Jonathan Barfield.
Well, I will continue the strong effort to be visible within the community. It's amazing how vast this district is, but how often you would see Congressman McIntyre at different events and different functions. I would indeed fight for this district to make sure, you know, as we talked earlier about earmarks, you know, as a representative, you're representing a district, not the entire United States of America. So therefore, my job would be indeed to make sure that the counties within this 7th Congressional District, the citizens in this district, get what they need from the federal government. Throughout the edge, we're all paying federal taxes, and I want to make sure that our state, that our district gets its fair return on its investment in our federal government. I don't know that I would do anything much different from what he's done in terms of that. He provided a great African-American Black History program every February within the 7th Congressional District. That's something that I would indeed continue. I found that it brought many people of diverse backgrounds together within the entire district, and allowed a sense of camaraderie and community to indeed be built, and that's something I would indeed applaud him on.
Thank you. Mr. Castine.
Mr. McIntyre was one of the last, if not the last, Blue Dog Democrat in Congress. And that label was based upon fiscal responsibility. That is certainly something that I would want to continue in Congress. And I believe that if the dollars don't work, then nothing else really matters. If the money's not there to do the things that need to be done, then the benefit of the program is going to be missing regardless. So we've got to figure out a way to make the dollars and cents work. One way to do that is through tax reform, fiscal responsibility, learning when to spend money, when not. There's avenues in the Defense Department. We have huge defense interests here in North Carolina, but there's also avenues to look at that we can cut from that. One thing that Mr. McIntyre did do was to challenge legislation. He wasn't a rubber stamp, and I think it's important as a congressman not to be a rubber stamp, to ask the important questions, to ask the challenging questions, to learn as much as possible about what's going on. I think that's one of the things that was lacking in the past couple of congressional sessions, is most of the control seems to be at the top, and the actual congressmen have very little say-so in what's going on, and I think that's something that needs to change, and I think that's something that Mr. McIntyre brought to the table and something that should be continued.
Thank you. You're listening to a special broadcast of the 7th Congressional District Candidates Forum here on 91.3 FM. Two of three candidates are with us tonight, Jonathan Barfield and Wesley Castine, a live studio audience, and Chris Brown from WWAY. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. And Chris Brown, you have a question from one of our listeners who has emailed a question.
This question comes in from Zachary Rudison. He says, do you believe an equal public education is the right of all North Carolina students? If so, then what can you do to ensure all schools have the resources they need to educate our students for the 21st century? Mr. Barfield?
And I'm sorry, let's begin with Wesley Castine.
Mr. Castine.
Education is certainly important. It's important from the ability of the individual to earn a living. It's important for the ability of the individual to be a positive contributor to his family and his community. It's important to be able to have citizens who are knowledgeable about the things that they find important in voting and making decisions in their everyday lives. And in the 21st century, it's particularly important that individuals recognize that starting a job with one company and retiring there is probably not something that they're going to do. They have to have the ability to retrain and retool themselves in order to be productive contributors to society. And public education is one of the most important tools to be able to do that, and it's something that has been a recognized part of state government for decades. It is something that will undoubtedly continue, but it is something that will be struggling because it is such a large funding part of state government. So there will always be a tug of war in order to properly fund and adequately fund both grade school and universities. And North Carolina has some excellent universities. North Carolina has good grade schools and quality teachers, and it's important to give the teachers the ability to provide the best education possible to the students.
Mr. Barfield.
You know, Chris, our campaign has been endorsed by the North Carolina Association of Educators. It shows our commitment to public education, and I believe that every child should have access to a quality education. As a county commissioner in New Hanover County, our budget, a third of our budget goes to our public education system. And a third of the school system budget is made up of our budget as well. And with the budget here in New Hanover County, we're paying for roughly 600 plus teachers or positions beyond what the state mandates. And as I look at the proliferation of charter schools and private schools taking away public tax dollars, it's watering down or it's adding an increased burden to the local taxpayers. So if we're taking money from the state and local communities to fund private schools and charter schools, you're going to look at a tax increase at the local level, the county level, to indeed make up for that difference. I volunteer so often within our schools. I'm proud of this great program that we helped launch about 4 years ago called the Watchdogs, which stands for Dads of Great Students. And it gives every child the ability to see a male operating within the school system as a volunteer. We started with about three or four elementary schools. Now we've got roughly 15 schools within New Hanover and Pender and Brunswick County with over 2,500 men, dads, volunteering within the school system to show these boys and girls a positive role model, which will indeed help them advance and excel in school. We've got to find ways to pay our teachers an adequate salary. We've had an export as opposed to an import of teachers into this state right now because of the low teacher pay that we're paying. It's time for our state and the federal government to step up.
Thank you. Mr. Barfield, the nation as a whole has started to ask more questions about how the police are using force and whether African Americans are unfairly targeted and treated. What are the lessons from Ferguson, Missouri, and does the U.S. need to rethink its approach to law enforcement?
I can tell you a personal lesson. My 23-year-old daughter, when we had our first birthday party, we had it at Greenfield Lake, and we rented a shelter out there. At the time, my dad was the county commissioner for New Hanover County, and I had some music set up, playing very low. There were some other folks sitting in another area that I'm sure hadn't paid for anything. And as my music was playing, me and my dad were getting the grill ready, and a police officer walked from the front of the park to where we were, and he didn't know my father, apparently. But my dad threw a soda can in the trash can, and this officer started rummaging through the trash can as if my dad had thrown a beer can or some drugs or something in there. And I didn't know what had happened that evening, but that Monday there was a county commission meeting. And at the time, they were discussing a noise ordinance here in the county. And then my father spoke up and said, well, I think that a noise ordinance will be unfair to African Americans, and this is why. This is what happened to me at my granddaughter's party in the park. And so I find that things do happen. You have some folks that will do racial profiling. It happens in this community. It happens across our country. And it's time for our police chiefs and our sheriffs across our nation to do sensitivity training with their officers, number one, to weed out those that have that mindset of racial profiling, and to recognize that every citizen deserves the same rights, not more rights or being followed because you are a certain color. It's often referred to as DWI or DWB, driving while black. And I've known folks in this community that have been pulled over for that. At the same time, I'm a strong supporter of law enforcement throughout our country.
Thank you. Mr. Castine.
I don't live in Ferguson, Missouri. I was not standing on that street when the young man was killed, so I can't speak to whether the use of force was reasonable or not. The only person who can answer that question today is probably the officer involved. In looking at that specific situation, the media took a theme, the media took a headline and ran with it. We have yet to determine the truth of that situation, and I believe one of the biggest lessons learned is not to jump to conclusions and allow the judicial system to play out so that the truth can be determined. That having been said, there is undoubtedly a history in this country related to the oppression of racial minorities, and Mr. Barfield has given a rather poignant example of that. What does need to happen is an education and understanding of police departments relating to use of force and appropriate use of force, and an education program that allows them to understand what is appropriate and what is not, and a better vetting of police officers in hiring practice, and knowing that the individuals that come in are capable of making those split-second decisions and are not likely to be persons that abuse the power they're invested in them.
Thank you. Chris Brown, your next question goes to Wesley Castine.
Mr. Castine, when articulating your congressional priorities, both of you have actually named economic development and job creation. How do you propose to have an impact in that regard?
The federal government has proven itself incapable of fixing the economy. The federal government proved itself quite capable of ending or averting the free fall of the economy during the initial stages of the Great Recession. The biggest thing that needs to happen for the economy to recover is for the federal government to more or less get out of the way. Not to micromanage the lives of 300 million citizens, not to tell business owners what products to sell, not to tell companies how to do their own business. If the government were capable of making those decisions, I would certainly bow to their knowledge and expertise, but the government has never proven itself capable of doing that. Proper way to handle it is to allow the economy to work its way out and to get out of the way. The government, in attempting to fix things, often causes more problems than it fixes, and ultimately it's going to be a trial and error within the business community that allows the United States to recover from the economic downturn.
Can you repeat that question, please?
Absolutely. When articulating your congressional priorities, both of you named economic development and job creation. How do you propose to have an impact in that regard?
Chris, I have already had an impact as a county commissioner. Since being on the Board of Commissioners here from November of 2008 to present, I've helped to bring over 735 jobs to Nunavut County with over $135 million in corporate investment at the same time. It's about providing the right climate for businesses to come and grow. It's about having the right infrastructure in place. From a federal standpoint, infrastructure is so very important. It's amazing that when the stimulus package was passed, our K-Fair Public Utility Authority had the ability to take federal dollars, which our citizens had paid into, to help extend water and sewer services to our community. But because of politics, they decided not to. I would take the federal dollars that are available to these local communities here within the 7th District, make sure that adequate water and sewer is indeed available so that when businesses come, they can set up and thrive. It is often said here in New Albany County that we don't have sites. We have land for sale in terms of, as opposed to a site. And for a business, a site is something that has water and sewer already there, the right infrastructure in place. And that's going to be key and critical. When you look at Brunswick County, the fact that they have an industrial incubator there, Pender County is looking at doing the same exact thing. Northampton County is doing some of the same exact things. We've got to find ways to make sure that the infrastructure is in place, but also partnering with our community colleges to train the workforce so that when a company comes to a community, they can see that there's already a trained workforce in place that can do that particular job, and they're more apt to come to our community. So again, partnering from the state and federal level with our schools.
Thank you. Jonathan Barfield, in a May 2014 Senate primary debate in North Carolina, all four Republican candidates were asked, is climate change a fact? All four candidates responded with a resounding no. Now the question goes to you, is climate change a fact? If so, how should the United States government and the world respond? If it's not, why not?
You know, I do believe that climate change is indeed a fact. The fact that our ozone layer has been impacted by the many carbons that are being emitted. When you look at the fact that our county was slated to be one of the only counties in our state to reach non-attainment a couple of years ago because of the SO2 emissions alone. And it's something that we, as elected officials, fought. I made a trip to Washington, D.C. to talk to Lisa Jackson, who was in charge of the EPA, about how can we mitigate this particular fact right here in our own community. When you look at the fact that our ice caps are melting at an alarming rate, you look at the fact that sea level rise is indeed occurring, I truly believe that it's there. What we can do is, number one, what our country is doing now, producing vehicles that are burning and putting out less emissions, which indeed will help strengthen the ozone layer. And we're finding that now that those cars are coming out, that our ozone layer is indeed getting better. But also looking at ways that we can have our coal burning facilities reduced, and then putting the right controls on those emissions that are coming out. We're looking at refurbishing our waste-to-energy facility. We're looking at different scrubbing mechanisms to indeed decrease the amount of particulate matter going into the atmosphere as opposed to increasing that. So those are things that the federal government can do.
Thank you. Wesley Castine.
I think there's adequate evidence that the Industrial Revolution and the resulting changes in the way we as humans live is impacting the climate. The bigger question I would ask is, that being the case, what do we do about it? As the world's largest economy, the United States is often looked to make the changes to decrease emissions and to make the sacrifices that are necessary to implement more costly fuel alternatives to those that are currently available. The reality is that the emerging economies in areas such as India and China will be ramping up production of their fossil fuel facilities in the coming years at a much higher level than the United States could ever reduce its carbon emissions. So the question is, does the United States handicap itself by requiring lower carbon emissions as a matter of EPA policy while the other countries continue to burn fossil fuels at a much higher rate? The question is going to have to be one of balanced response and to understand what the practicalities is across the world, not just here in the United States.
Thank you. Chris Brown, your next question goes to Wesley Castine.
Mr. Castine, what would a successful immigration reform policy look like to you? How would you like to see the issue of illegal immigration resolved?
What it doesn't look like is the last 30 years since the last amnesty program under President Reagan in 1986, at which time 3 million illegal immigrants were granted amnesty and allowed to stay in the country. At that time, there was a promise by the federal government to redo the immigration system to make it more efficient and more appropriate, and to close the porous borders of the United States. Both of those measures have failed miserably. At this time, we have approximately 11 million more persons who either entered the country illegally or have overstayed their visas and are here without the proper documentation. The harder question relates to children who came to the United States with their parents who didn't have any real choice in the matter. Those children, most of the times, don't speak a foreign language. They speak English. They've educated in the schools. So to consider anything other than to recognize them as residents of the United States and to address that directly would be unreasonable. That having been said, people that knowingly entered the United States illegally, I do not feel should be rewarded for having broken the laws of the United States and be given a direct path to citizenship.
Mr. Barfield?
You know, it's often said that we all came here on different ships, but we're in the same boat now. You know, as I look at the landscape of immigration, I go back to the Native Americans that were here, and I wonder what was on their minds when so many came here and brought diseases and whatnot to this place we call America now. I truly believe that we should have a 10-year pathway to citizenship. I am in favor of the Senate's version of that. We have so many that are coming here to our fine universities and being educated, and when their education visas expire, they go back to their native lands. And I would assume keep those individuals here in our country with their master's degrees and their PhDs and help propel the U.S. economy, to help work in our fine universities, to educate more minds within our communities as well. Traveling throughout the rural counties in the 7th Congressional District, there are so many farms that rely on labor that is not traditional. Sampson County recently, I saw a whole bunch of individuals going out pulling up potatoes. And my question is this, who's going to do that work? From the agricultural standpoint, those that are farming, they're trying to figure out how do we make sure that we have labor here to bring our crops in, because an average American citizen is not going to go out there and do that type of labor anymore. So therefore, I'm in favor of a 10-year pathway to citizenship for all.
Thank you. It's time now for our candidates' closing statement. Since we ended the last question with Wesley Castine beginning first, Jonathan Barfield will deliver the first closing statement. You have 2 minutes beginning now.
You know, my favorite author, John Maxwell, says it best. Everything rises and falls on leadership. And our slogan is simply this: proven, trusted leadership. You serve me, you see me serve here as a county commissioner for the past 6 years. You've watched my leadership. You watched me be chairman of the board twice and vice chair of the board twice. You see me now as chairman of the Department of Social Services. You see me lead in our community to bring new and bold initiatives to New Hanover County government. And now I want to take those same things to Washington, D.C. You see me work in concert with others to produce over 735 jobs in our community with $130 million in corporate investment. You see me start a watchdogs program within our community to make sure that every boy and girl sees someone that looks like them in terms of male role models within our school system. You see me be married to my bride for 26 years and have that commitment to her and my four daughters. You see me active within the entire community here in New Hanover County. But now it's time to take that same thing to Washington, D.C. It is so important that we have an elected official that is of the people and also for the people. I'm the average American citizen here in our community, and I get it. I understand the needs of those that are within this particular district. I find that there's so many are tired of the Hatfields and McCoy mentality in Washington, and I get that. They're tired of the partisan bickering, and I get that as well. You see me lead New Hanover County government in its first strategic planning session in over 17 years. And with that, we came up with a great plan to propel our economy and actually set money in our budget for economic development. You've seen those things happen within this young man named Jonathan Barfield for the past 6 years. You put your trust in me to reelect me in 2012, and now I'm asking for the same exact thing in 2014 to elect me as your congressman. I didn't just decide to run for this office. Last February of 2013, I made an announcement then of my intention to run for this office. There were so many throughout the community that asked me to run because of my ideology, because of the fact that they've seen me serve in so many various capacities within our community, and they saw that I had a heart for the people.
Thank you. Mr. Castine, 2 minutes.
The question that I have tonight is, how many votes does it take to earn the privilege of representing the 7th Congressional District? According to Mr. Rouser's math, who's the candidate who's not here tonight, that number must be around 23,010. That's the number of votes that Mr. Rouser received in the Republican primary. 23,000 is roughly 3% of the population of the 7th District. It's less than 5% of the voters in the 7th District, and it's even less than 15% of the card-carrying Republicans in the 7th District. In fact, nearly half of the voters who voted in the last two Republican primaries voted for a candidate other than Mr. Rouser. Being the nominee of a reluctant Republican Party, for the second time, Mr. Rouser seems to feel entitled, destined, to be your next congressman. Instead, I'd like to speak to Democrats who make up more than 40% of the 7th District. And I'd like to say you have a choice in this election. To the more than 100,000 libertarians and unaffiliated voters, I'd like to say to you as well, you have a choice in this election. And to the 85% of Republicans who did not vote in the latest primary or who chose a candidate other than Mr. Rouser, you still have a choice in this election. Mr. Rouser is hoping that you don't notice his absence here tonight, that you don't care about his policies, or that you just won't vote. Every single vote is important. No vote is ever wasted except one that is uncast. Once you've carefully examined your options, I would hope that you would choose Wesley Castine as your next congressman. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's all the time we have. I'd like to thank our candidates, Jonathan Barfield and Wesley Castine. I'd also like to thank Chris Brown and WWAY News Channel 3 for partnering with us tonight. Finally, heartfelt thanks to all of you who contributed thoughtful questions. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Remember to vote. Early voting begins on October 23rd, and Election Day is November 4th. Thank you and good night.